My guest is comic Jackie Mason, whose one-man show, The World According to Me, is one of the hottest tickets on Broadway. This Tony Award-winning show has generated more attention than anything he's done since the early 60s, when he made frequent appearances on The Ed Sullivan Show. Mason comes from a long line of rabbis, and to fulfill his father's wishes, he entered the rabbinate as a young man. The nightclubs where he later established himself as a comic took him far away from the synagogue, but on the other hand, a lot of his material is still about being Jewish. He does a lot of self-deprecating Jewish humor, and he also gets in Gentile, Polish, Black, Puerto Rican, and wife jokes. Jackie Mason's The World According to Me has just been published in book form by Simon & Schuster. There's also a new recording of his show from that album. This is an excerpt of his monologue on the differences between Jews and Gentiles.
A Jew's whole life is absolutely different than a Gentile's. It's fascinating to notice that a Jew can't even fix a car. Did you ever notice that? He cannot fix anything. A Gentile car breaks down in 2 seconds. They're under the car, on top of the car. They clock, they hack, it becomes an airplane. Pfft, there he goes. A Jewish car breaks down, you always hear the same thing. It stopped. And the wife always says, it's your fault. And he says, I know what it is, it's in the hood. Where's the hood? I don't remember there was a hood. Takes a Jew 3 hours to open a hood, then he looks under the hood. Hey, is it busy here? Then he makes a move and she hollers, watch out, you'll hurt yourself. I'm not making it up. Go into any Gentile home. Any Gentile home is a workshop. Why is that? The whole house is a workshop. Every place you go in a Gentile home, they clock, they hack. They take you right to the basement and they clock, and they hack, and they're fixing and banging and clanging. A Jewish house is a museum. The whole house is a museum. The Gentiles are clapping and the Jews are clapping. Every Gentile, as soon as you say hello, he's fixing and building. The whole house was rebuilt and refixed. The toilet was once a chair. The living room was once a ping pong table. The bedroom was once a kitchen. This was some melt. The furnace was once a toilet. This was some... The whole lobby was in the lap. This was some melt. The wall was in the... This was in Pittsburgh. Everything was someplace else. Go into a Jewish house, nothing was ever fixed. Everything was imported, exported. In a Jewish house, everything is coming and going. It's a whole shipping department, the whole house. No matter what you see, this is nothing. Wait till you see what I'm getting.
Jackie Mason, you come from an Orthodox family of rabbis. Were you exposed to comics or to nightclubs when you were growing up?
Not only wasn't I exposed to comics, I never even heard of comics. I didn't know there was such a thing as comedians when I was growing up. I thought when I was funny around the table in the house, I thought I was the only person who knew how to be funny in this whole world. I never saw comedians because you're always in the yeshiva, which is a Hebrew academy to study to become a rabbi. And the only thing I saw was rabbis in front of me, teaching me to keep my mouth shut, not to talk, not to say something funny, not to talk aloud, not to talk at all, not to move, not to turn, just to sit and pass away right in front of people. That's all you're taught. It's a very rigid kind of an atmosphere, and certainly nightclubs was the most distant thing from my life. It's like mining for uranium. You didn't see it in the neighborhood.
Do you remember?
You know uranium exists, but you don't expect to bump into it.
Do you remember the first time you went to a nightclub and saw a comic?
As a matter of fact, the first time I was ever in a nightclub where a comic was performing, it was me.
You're kidding.
I never was in the inside of a nightclub. I knew of a nightclub from movies by that time. Because I saw a few pictures, Humphrey Bogart would go into a nightclub, so I knew what it meant. But I was never actually personally inside of a nightclub until I myself played a nightclub. What happened was that I was in the mountains in the Catskills, and I was telling jokes, and I was a big hit among the Jewish people in a small hotel. And the next thing I knew, somebody wanted to take a chance with me in a nightclub. And that was my first appearance at a nightclub, and it's the first time I was ever in there.
So you kind of had to make it up as you went along as far as what your act was going to be like. You had nobody to pattern it on.
I had nobody to pattern it on at the beginning except what I thought sounded funny to me that made people laugh. And I found that making people laugh came very natural and easy to me.
It's funny. You've said that you became a rabbi because you didn't want to disobey your father, and your father wanted you to become a rabbi. And it's ironic to think of someone like you who's built their career on irreverence to be afraid of going against their father.
Well, the truth of the matter is, it was very difficult for me psychologically to give up the religion and the rabbinate and everything that religion represented, because I knew that my father lived for nothing but this. It was a history going back a million years. It's like the King of England when he got off the throne. Everybody else says, so what if you're not a king? There's a lot of people who are not kings. Thank God you're not, so go for a walk, keep yourself busy. But to him, not to be a king was a difficult problem, because he was born to be a king. In the same sense, I was born to be a rabbi. I was born to be a rabbi more than he was to be a king. That guy had no troubles compared to me. He only had countries involved. I had a mother and a father sitting in front of me, getting nauseous every 5 minutes, passing away from the misery.
Did you learn anything about timing and working an audience when you were delivering sermons as a rabbi?
As a matter of fact, that's a good question. You know, it's hard to believe that you're going to get a good question on a show like this. But this is a very good question. I'm kidding. I hope you noticed that. I noticed you're not laughing when I said that.
I didn't know how to take it.
Because this is a very incisive question. Very few people think of asking a question that has that much insight. I'm proud of that question. I'm so proud of the question, I forgot the answer. Anyway, the point is that there is a very great similarity between a rabbi delivering sermons and a comedian telling jokes. Because if a rabbi is strictly serious on the pulpit, he'll lose his whole audience in an hour, because people don't really go to a congregation or a religious house of worship to practice religion. They go there to practice everything but religion. It's a community center of activity. It's the only place where the Jewish people get together, and they're there for different reasons than religion. Ostensibly, the pretense, it's a religious house of worship, but everybody's there for everything but that. They're comparing coats, they're comparing jackets, they're comparing bank books. Who has a bigger diamond than who? Who had a baby? Who could have had a baby? Who had a baby that was married, that never got married, that forgot to get married? It's a place where they gossip about each other's lives, because it's the only place they get together. It's like Gentiles have a bar, Jews have a temple.
So,
and the Jewish temple becomes the place where you gossip about everything. And when the rabbi, when he starts preaching to you about religion, he's only an intrusion. He's a disturbance to them. All of a sudden, you have to keep quiet, and you can't pass all the gossip around.
Is this a place where you could let your sense of humor come out?
So if the rabbi was missing or passed away, they'd be much happier. However, if he's a capable rabbi, he has to try to find a way to mesh that need of the people for gossip and entertainment, and also at the same time slip some significance into his messages, because he's morally obligated to do it, to teach them and preach to them about something moral, meaningful, about the life of the hereafter, about more profound thoughts and ideas of why we're here on this earth. But if he just stays that serious, philosophical and religious, he'll lose the whole congregation in an hour and a half. He'll be talking to himself, and everybody will be sleeping in the place. It'll please become a bedroom instead of a congregation if he gets that serious. So he has to try to be entertaining, and the most effective rabbis always try to bring it down to the common denominator and try to talk about things that interest them in terms and in ways that will entertain them at the same time that he delivers his point.
So you told some jokes.
Right. And the jokes got better and better. Then I started to charge a cover at a minimum. That's a joke for my act.
Right, right. And my guest is Jackie Mason, who has a very big hit on Broadway now called The World According to Me. And there's also a book called The World According to Me that features some of his material from that show, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster. You got your start as a comic in the Borscht Belt, in the Jewish resort hotels of the Catskill Mountains in New York. The Borscht Belt always had comic headliners, and
right.
I wonder why you think that there are so many Jewish comics and why Jewish audiences really love comics so much.
That's also a very good question. I'm really surprised you're this intelligent a person. I never heard this about you. Listen to this. I almost heard you laugh again. It's not easy. Listen, the reason that Jews are so fascinated with comedy, in my opinion, is because Jews were always felt like a beleaguered minority, always felt like they were being persecuted, and as a matter of fact, always were being persecuted. And when you can't fight back and there's no way out of your misery and the problems that you're suffering from, you try to make life more bearable by telling some jokes to each other, by trying to be funny, by trying to find humor in the situation. People need an escape. Let's be honest about it. There's a lot of studies have been made about the times when the movies are most popular, and they found movies are most popular in the Depression periods, when people need escape the most. Now, ostensibly, people go for entertainment when they have more money and when times are better. That's what people thought. But when they made a study of it, they found exactly the opposite is true. that people go to the movies more when times are worst.
You told us that you had really never seen comics and hadn't been in nightclubs until you started performing yourself. Once you started performing, I'm sure you started seeing other Jewish comics like Myron Cohen, who was considerably older than you. How did you think you compared to the older generation of Jewish comics who had a lot of Yiddish material in their act?
I'll be honest with you. It's a misnomer to imagine that I have Jewish material in my act, because I don't. I sound so Jewish that people think I'm talking Jewish. Then they imagine I'm talking about Jewish subjects. The fact of the matter is I'm talking about nothing that has anything to do with Jewishness. It's just that I'm so Jewish, you got mesmerized into thinking I'm telling you Jewish jokes.
But you use Yiddish in your material.
I definitely don't.
Oh, wait. How about Mekluxmir? Did I say that right?
That's a meaningless little expression that I might use, mechakt, meklapt. It's a meaningless word that I just use as an expression. And you find maybe two Jewish expressions in 2 hours of my performance. None of my jokes are in Jewish, and none of my subject matter is particularly Jewish. I talk about life in general. Sometimes I talk about how Jews behave compared to Gentiles, or there's a lot of ethnic comedy in my jokes. But the ethnic comedy is about the difference in people's behavior patterns in accordance to their ethnic backgrounds, which is basically a sociological study. It's not in any way a Jewish approach to comedy. I don't tell jokes about Jews like in the same sense that Myron Cohen does, with depicting the typical Jewish character and using a Jewish accent to express a Jewish personality. I just happen to talk with an accent.
One of the very funny things you say in your show is that you're comparing Gentile and Jewish audience reactions to your show, and you say that the Gentiles see the show and they say, it's a hit, and the Jews see the show and they say, it's too Jewish.
Right.
Is this a typical reaction that you get?
It's. I don't know if it's typical, but it's certainly pretty common, because the Jews, as I say in my act, are very self-conscious about being Jewish. I say they suffer from a terrible conflict constantly. They like to tell you how proud they are to be Jewish, but if a person is so proud, why would he cut off his name and his nose? Jews cut off their names and noses more than any other denomination in the world, at the same time that they tell you with such pride about how Jewish they are. If you're so proud, I don't notice Italians cutting off their names. If he's Italian and his name is Mangiapane, he doesn't call himself Mange, he's Mangiapane. You don't hear a Polish person whose name is Askarachowicz all of a sudden call him Ashkapa. He's Ashkapachowicz, whatever his name is. But as soon as a Jew is named Goldberg, he becomes Gold, then he becomes Good, then he becomes Heheh. He doesn't want to have too much of a name that should sound Jewish. Jewish women are notoriously embarrassed and disturbed. They even get nauseous if you tell them they look Jewish. You tell a Gentile girl she looks Jewish, she thinks, well, that sounds continental. You tell it to a Jewish girl, I look Jewish, she wants to pass away in a second.
My guest is Jackie Mason.
That's right.
Let's talk about 1964, when you did the now famous Ed Sullivan show, and you were in the middle of your routine. He was gesturing you to get off because he had just gotten word that the president was going to make a short speech and it was going to interrupt the program. So he was gesturing you to get off, and you were gesturing him with the same kind of fingers he was giving you. He later said that you gave him the finger. You denied it. There was almost a suit and a countersuit. But anyways, what went through your mind when he was giving you the signals to get off?
Boy, you do a lot of homework.
I watched the show, didn't you?
Oh, you watched the show at that time?
All of America was watching the Ed Sullivan show then,
oh,
right?
Oh, boy. You know everything. You're like an encyclopedia of my career.
You're not enjoying this interview very much, are you?
No, I love it. I love it. I'm getting a kick out of the fact that you paid that much attention. I certainly love it. That's a great compliment that somebody knows that much about you. Anyway, the point is that what happened there, as you just recounted it, is exactly right. That's exactly what did happen. You sound like you just read about it last night, because the fact is that he misunderstood my gesture, because he himself thought that when a guy moves a finger, the only thing he himself could think of was a dirty gesture. Because he came from the New York streets, and he knew about dirty gestures. I came from rabbinical institutions all my life, and I never heard of a dirty gesture when I came to his show. I had no idea what it even meant. Now, the proof of the matter is that I was right. I was telling this to people for 20 years, and they were very cynical when I would say it this way, because they would say, who is he kidding? He didn't know what it meant. He's a phony. Because Ed Sullivan called me a fraud. and a liar, and he said that I purposely gave him a filthy gesture. So naturally, if he's the superstar and the symbol of authority in America, and I'm a young budding comedian who doesn't mean that much, they have to assume that I'm the liar and he's telling the truth. And then they even imagined they saw what he told them they saw, a filthy gesture. But just 2 months ago, on 2020, Barbara Walters replayed that actual scene from the old tape. And when they replayed the tape, they actually went in slow motion following my gesture. I don't know if you saw that particular show.
I actually saw that too, yeah.
And they proved on television that I never made such a gesture. Barbara Walters said to America, isn't it amazing how a person could be so misunderstood?
You know what amazes me?
Yes.
How you could have performed for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years and still not known what the finger was?
Because I was never performing among... I didn't even know, to this day, I don't even know what the pot looks like or what or what is that thing, Coke. I wouldn't know Coke if I saw it, if I fell over it. I never mingled with people who talk this way or behave this way, and I still don't. And I was never involved in the street corner type of conversation. To this day, I don't tell dirty jokes. I don't use one off-color word, and I never have. That's just not my character or my nature. Now, people who live like that, maybe people like you who know from these things, can't find it hard for you to believe that I don't, because I happen to live a much cleaner life than you.
Right, well, I guess when the interview's over, I should inform you about the things you've been missing out on, right? So after this...
I really don't know from these things. It's not the way I live.
So after this happened on the Ed Sullivan Show, did you feel like you were being blacklisted?
I was not being blacklisted, but it really put a bad damper in my career. I can't deny that, because I was a very hot piece of property at that time. I seemed to be zooming with a brilliant new career. I was a conversation piece as the new hot comic, or one of the 2-3 hottest comics in the country. I was not yet a major star, but it looked like I was being offered every major situation that I would inevitably become a major star in a very short order. And all of a sudden, that put a definite crimp in it. All of a sudden, people saw me as some kind of a crazy maniac who can't be trusted. When Ed Sullivan said that this man did a filthy thing, people who watched the show actually thought they saw it, and they never did. But that's amazing power of suggestion. If the chief rabbi of Israel tells all the Jews they're passing away on Thursday, they'll start to think they are.
My guest is Jackie Mason, and his one-man show is a big hit on Broadway now. It's called The World According to Me. The World According to Me is also the title of his new book, which features a lot of the material that he's doing in the show.
It's not only a big hit, it's a phenomenal, unbelievable kind of a happening. People all over the world are coming from China, from Africa. They're coming without clothes because they don't even get a chance to get dressed. They're in such a hurry to get there.
Well, we'll have more adjectives about this show after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Comedian Jackie Mason is my guest. Since you've been back in New York, have you gone back to your old neighborhood in the Lower East Side of Manhattan?
I have been in the neighborhood a couple of times and just rode around a little to look at it. It's a totally different kind of a neighborhood now. It was the whole world changed there. It used to be mostly very poor, poverty-stricken Jews. Now it's mostly Puerto Rican and Spanish and some black people, and they seem to be doing better than the Jews did at that time. Because thank God now there's more opportunities to get some help from the government. At that time, there was almost nothing 30, 40 years ago.
Your brothers are still rabbis, even though you left the rabbinate. They're still rabbis. Do you ever go to their services?
Yes, I was just there for the high holidays. And I'll be there again on Yom Kippur, which is the next high holiday, Friday night.
So do you have to stand up and take a bow in the middle of the service?
Well, I can't deny that they get pretty excited about me showing up. It's like the boy coming back home, and it's a fabulous feeling to see how much pleasure they get out of my becoming such a hit. Becoming a hit is a stunning feeling. You always read constantly about some people who can't handle success and how they suffer with success and how it makes them miserable and how some people want to commit suicide who are so successful, how it has an adverse opposite kind of effect on some people. I don't know why and how it could be possible unless the person is terrifically sick, and that person should immediately go for help. It's like if I give you $3 million and you can't enjoy it, and the only thing you could say is that it's making you suffer, then you better run to a doctor immediately. That's a lot worse than a bad case of tonsils.
You started out without any experience having seen comics. Did comics take you under their wing and bring you into the club, so to speak?
I'll tell you frankly, I'm not too close to too many comedians. I find that there's too much jealousy among comedians. This is a very, very insecure, nerve-wracking business. Everybody's on an ego trip that's usually sick to one extent or another. Most people don't become comedians because they want to entertain people. They become comedians because they feel rejected and nervous and helpless. All the studies made about comedians and their personality structure shows that they're all psycho cases. That it's very hard to find a normal comedian. A person who's so desperate for attention that he has to become a comedian, it has to be sick to start with. It has to be a chemical or emotional imbalance. You have to feel terribly rejected in your house, in your home, in your environment. There was a big brother who was 10 times smarter. There was a sister who was 10 times prettier. You were the one neglected, rejected. You were really short, fat, or ugly, or miserable, nauseous, and disturbed. And you got absolutely nothing to live for. As a desperate move, you take a chance and you become a comedian. That's how most comedians start. And all the studies made of their character, their personalities, proves that they almost always start from a warped position of a sick personality. And then the answer to a terrible personality problem and a terrible feeling of total rejection is to either hide completely or to go in exactly the opposite direction. You either be, it's like the old story. From one family, you either become a murderer or a judge. One brother becomes a murderer, the next one a judge from the same family. And people say, why? It's because both people needed something extreme to overcome the misery of their circumstances. A comedian is in a very extreme way of looking for attention. You know how sick you have to be to go up on a stage in Iowa with the people that never heard of you, and you're 19 or 22 years old, and you have to beg people to laugh at you with jokes that are not finished yet, and feel all the rejection and the contempt that people have for a person who is wasting their time not being funny. If you sing a song and it stinks, nobody notices it because they heard of the song, it's close enough, it's better than nothing. But if you hear a joke you never heard before and it stinks, you're wasting the guy's time and the guy is getting nauseous and he wants to throw a chair at you.
Is this a way of saying that you've been a psycho case yourself and that's right. Why you're a comedian?
That's right. I can't deny it. I certainly am. I always felt rejected in my environment at home. I had three brothers older than me. I always felt left out. The brother right above me was a phenomenal genius. He's an absolute genius. Yet by the time he was 9, he was graduating from 4 universities. He was getting medals of honor from people who had never heard of him. He was sitting around with all kinds of medals like a general. And I was the one who nobody noticed. So I started to try to be funny. It's not hard to tell what motivated me to try to look for attention in one way or another. And to overcompensate by being the belle of the ball, by becoming a comedian. Because I knew I couldn't compete with him scholastically or intellectually.
Do you think you put on a stronger Yiddish accent for your act than you do when you're talking?
I have no awareness at all about my accent. As a matter of fact, I never even knew I had an accent. I always concentrated on the substance of the significance of the meaning of the message, of the point that I'm trying to make, of the way to construct the joke to make it as funny as possible. But it was all in the construction of the words and the thoughts and the ideas behind it. It never was involving any kind of a style of performance. Of a style of delivery. I never concentrated on how to deliver a joke in terms of my words or my moves or my gestures. I never thought of that. The performance element was never involved in my mind at all, and it's still not.
You seem to me to be one of the comics who's never had any writers write for them. Is that right?
Right. I never did.
Well, why?
Because I don't need them. Why don't I have somebody sit down for me? Because I sit down myself. Why don't I go for somebody to dance for me? I dance myself. If this is my business, I don't feel like I need somebody else to do it for me. Not that I'm reflecting against the ones who do. There's nothing wrong with doing words that somebody else wrote. If you could do them effectively and get the same laugh, who says that you have to write it yourself? Nobody does. People play Shakespeare. They don't have to be Shakespeare. But I don't find that I need somebody else to write for me. I like what I come up with, and I am involved in my own thoughts, and it expresses my own ideas. And one of the pleasures in my mind, as much as performing it, is the thought of it, and I'd like to be the one who thought of it.
You make all these comparisons in your routines between Jews and Gentiles. Let's see which of them hold up for you. That Jews aren't handy around the house, don't know how to fix cars, anything like that. What about you?
The fact of the matter is that most of these jokes happen to be a reflection of me. I really can't fix a car, and I don't have one friend that I know that could. So I find it very typical. You see, none of these generalities obviously pertain to everyone. If you meet 300 Jews, you'll usually find one that could actually fix a car. But if you meet 300 Gentiles, you'll meet 280 that could fix a car.
Okay, let's try another one. That when your show is over, you can tell the difference between a Jew and a Gentile because the Gentile will say, let's go have a drink, and the Jew will say, have you eaten yet?
Now, that is the very biggest laugh in my whole act, because obviously it must be more true than anything else. You could tell by the size of a laugh how true something is. Unless there's instant fantastic identification with the truth of a line, you'll never get a major reaction from it, because they won't know exactly what the point is, or they won't feel the point. When they feel it in their guts is when you know you're a real hit. As soon as I say Gentiles never finish drinking and Jews never finish eating, every Gentile leaving this building is going to say the same thing, have a drink. Everybody breaks up, and since there's more Jews in the audience usually than Gentiles, it's about 60-70% Jewish. As soon as I say that, and the Jews all say the same thing too, did you eat yet? Every Jew falls off the floor, because it's exactly true. They know how exactly true it is. Jews are always talking about food. If you meet a Gentile, the first thing he says to you, where can we go for a drink? You meet a Jew, they always say, where can we go for coffee? But they won't go there for coffee unless they know they have good cake in that place, because a Gentile refers to coffee as coffee. When a Jew talks about coffee, he's thinking about cake.
So what about you? Do you eat more than you drink?
I never drink at all. I don't drink liquor.
Really?
No.
So, but are you really preoccupied with food?
I don't know if I'm preoccupied, but I know that it's a great part of my life in terms of my conversation and my choices of restaurants. Why do you think Jews inhabit restaurants a lot more than Gentiles do, percentage-wise? Everybody who owns a restaurant will tell you that if he's in a Jewish neighborhood, he's a hit in 5 minutes, because as soon as a Jew sees a restaurant, he goes there to try it out. And he doesn't care what kind of food it is. The Jews are always eating foods they never heard of. A Gentile eats his own type of food. If he wants a steak, he wants a roast beef. A Jew is always looking for Australian food. They're looking for food they never heard of. Did you hear about this new New Zealand dish? Did you hear? They're not talking about a girl, they're talking about food. They're always thinking of dishes they never heard of, exotic dishes, an Albanian cheese. They're looking for something that they always find a new item.
Well, now that you're back in New York, are you frequenting a lot of delicatessens?
Right. I'm a big hit in the Carnegie Delicatessen. I'm there almost every day.
Are you really?
Yes.
People will be coming to see right. You, I'm sure.
Right.
Well, Jackie Mason, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. You're a lovely lady. I haven't seen you yet, but I love your attitude and your intelligence of your questioning.
Thanks for doing the interview. My guest has been Jackie Mason, and his hit Broadway show, The World According to Me, has been adapted into a record as well as a book. The book, The World According to Me, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.